So there we are. That's where we are. We have gone through Saul, David, and Solomon, the period of the United Kingdom of Israel that lasted 120 years. I mean, 120 years doesn't even sound like much in the history of our country. It's a very, very short space of time historically. And we come this morning to Act 3, a divided kingdom. This is what happens after Solomon. We come to the divided kingdom. Now, I have listed here three references in scene 1, which is called the kingdom split. And then we'll come to deal with Judah and Israel, or Israel and Judah separately. But let me, if I may, let me expand a little bit. And I want to go to, if you would, turn, if you want to turn to 1 Kings chapter 11. I want to go back, even though I started the references in chapter 12. I feel we need to go back to chapter 11 to fill in the context and get a little more perspective on this. So let me read from, and I'm going to read selected passages and intersperse a few comments. So here we go. 1 Kings 11, I want to begin at verse 9. Here's how it starts. Here's how the story starts. The Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who appeared to him twice. God had actually appeared to this guy twice, you know, once when he asked for wisdom, and the other time when he was dedicating the temple. Although he had forbidden Solomon to follow other gods, Solomon did not keep the Lord's command. So the Lord said to Solomon, "Since this is your attitude and you have not kept my covenant and my decrees, which I commanded you, I will most certainly," listen to this, "I will most certainly tear the kingdom away from you and give it to one of your subordinates." That's where the situation is. That's where Solomon has brought it. Solomon with no heart. So we come to the first note here in the notes, and it is that Rehoboam responds harshly and Jeroboam revolts. Now what we have to understand, here's what we have to understand, just to, so that we can follow the story. What we're going to have is we're going to have a divided kingdom with Israel. I'll come back in a minute and do the little sketches for the sketch sheet, but let me just lay this out to begin with. We have Israel that's going to end up as the nation in the north and Judah in the south. So we'll have Israel and Judah, right? Israel, Judah. Judah is going to be ruled by one of Solomon's sons, Rehoboam. So we'll call him Reb. And Israel is going to be ruled by one of Solomon's supervisors of his building projects, Jeroboam. So we'll call him Jerry. So there's Jerry and Reb. Jerry in the north and Reb in the south. And they're going to be in charge of things. Rehoboam is the rightful king of all of Israel. Jeroboam's the one who institutes the revolt and splits things up. But as we see, it's part of God's plan because God said, "I'm going to tear the kingdom away from you because of your idolatry." So God raises up, in the following verses to what we read, God raises up a number of enemies, and then we come to verse 26. Also, Jeroboam, son of Nebat, rebelled against the king. He was one of Solomon's officials, an Ephraimite from Zereda, and his mother was a widow named Zeruah. You could do some poetry on that. What had happened was that Solomon had various building projects going on, and part of it was rebuilding the wall of Jerusalem, and part of it was to build up his terraces so that he could try and create one of the seven wonders of the world. And this Jeroboam became stood out as an exceptional supervisor in this work. And so he was recognized and respected by all. Well, Here's an interesting little incident beginning at verse 29. About that time, Jeroboam was going out of Jerusalem, and Ahijah, the prophet of Shiloh, met him on the way, wearing a new cloak. The two of them were alone out in the country. And Ahijah took hold of the new cloak he was wearing and tore it into 12 pieces. Then he said to Jeroboam, take 10 pieces for yourself, for this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. See, I am going to tear the kingdom out of Solomon's hand and give you 10 tribes. But for the sake of my servant David and the city of Jerusalem, which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, he will have one tribe. But I will take the whole kingdom out of Solomon's hand. I have made him ruler all the days of his life for the sake of David, my servant. If you want to underline those words as we go through, for the sake of David, for the sake of David. That comes up again and again. For the sake of David, my servant, whom I chose and who obeyed my commands and decrees. So he meets this prophet, and the prophet takes off his new cloak that he has on, and he tears it into 12 pieces, and then he says, look, Jeroboam, you're going to have 10, and there's only going to be one remaining. Now, those of you who are really sharp in math will understand that 10 plus 1 equals 12, right? So, is that right, Henry? So I thought, oh, good grief, what is going on here? So I looked and looked and looked and looked around all the commentaries and several explanations. Here's one explanation. That if you take the map of Israel, the map goes like this. Here's the end of the Mediterranean, right? And here's Galilee, and here's the Dead Sea, and here's Jerusalem. And the split is going to be right here, right north of Jerusalem, but that's going to leave their the wall of Jerusalem is going to be on the border if we only have the tribe of Judah. But the tribe of Benjamin is right here. And the tribe of Benjamin could protect the northern and be a buffer zone on the north side of Jerusalem. And so the tribe of Benjamin becomes essential to the defense of Jerusalem. So it's possible that the tribe of Benjamin, and scholars are a little bit divided as to where exactly Benjamin stood. Was Benjamin really loyal? Was part of Benjamin tribe loyal, the southern part, and the northern part may not have been? You know, it's kind of a... So it's possible that Benjamin has become kind of subsumed into Judah, and they're thought of as one unit, right? That's possible. Well, another possibility is that the tribe of Simeon is actually only given several villages within Judah. They don't amount to much. They don't really have a territory of their own. If you look in the map in the back of your Bible, the tribe of Simeon may be shown as a circle like this, but they don't have a territory as such. They're just kind of a little bit of... They have a few villages in Judah. So it's possible that the tribe of Simeon's excluded, right? I suppose another possibility is that the tribe of Levi is excluded to make up the 11 because... Well, actually, it'd be 12, but... Because the tribe of Levi doesn't have a territory. They're scattered, right? But then... There's also a problem with the numbers because, remember, the tribes of Manasseh, what's the other one? Joseph's son, what was Joseph's other? Ephraim and Manasseh. There was the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh who were the two guys who were Joseph's sons. And if you take a tribe for Ephraim and a tribe for Manasseh, that's two, but Joseph was only one. So that's 13 tribes. So there's all kinds of ways of explaining this. But anyway... I don't know what the explanation is. Those are what commentators suggest. Well, now we come to chapter 12. Let me read from verse 1. Rehoboam went to Shechem. That was sort of the gathering place. That was in the southern part of the northern tribes, but it was kind of the recognized center for the northern tribes. And so he went to Shechem because he could not just be crowned in Judah. There was already pretty good friction between Judah and the other tribes. He couldn't just be crowned in Judah and recognized by the northern tribes, so he travels up to Shechem. For all Israel had gathered there to make him king. When Jeroboam, son of Nebat, heard this, he was still in Egypt, where he had fled from King Solomon. He returned from Egypt. So they sent for Jeroboam, and he and the whole assembly of Israel went to Rehoboam and said to him, "Your father put a heavy yoke on us, but now lighten the harsh labor and the heavy yoke he put on us, and we will serve you." Right? Watch what happens. He's told them to go away for 3 days and come back in 3 days, and he'd give them his decision. This is Rehoboam, the rightful king. He's going to give them his decision. And they're a little skeptical. So he goes and he consults the elders. And the elders say, be kind to them. You know, be gentle with them, and they will not revolt against you. Right? And then he says, well, let me consult the young guys. So he goes and consults the young guy. You know, no slur intended. And here's what the young guys say. Now tell them, my little finger is thicker than my father's waist. My father laid on you a heavy yoke. I will make it even heavier. My father scourged you with whips. I will scourge you with scorpions. So he gets these two views from the one from the older guys who say, look, take it easy, be gentle. You're going to cause trouble if you... And the young guys say, no, lay it on them. Just, you know, give it to them. He followed the advice of the young guys. As I say, no slur intended. I've known a lot of very wise young guys who have taught me a lot. When all Israel saw that the king refused to listen to them, they answered the king. This is verse 16. What share do we have in David? What part in Jesse's son? To your tents, Israel. Look after your own house, David. So they called the Judah David, and Israel is the northern part. And he said, look to your tents, O Israel. Look after your own house, David. So the Israelites went home. And what that virtually means is the kingdom split. We have two kingdoms. So Jeroboam settles in Jerusalem. That's our next point. Jeroboam settles in Jerusalem. Rehoboam settles in Jerusalem, right? Jeroboam's in the north. He's up north. Rehoboam's in the south. We only have half the lights on. Okay. When Rehoboam had come to... This is verse 21. When Rehoboam had come to Jerusalem, he assembled all the house of Judah and the tribe of Benjamin, 180,000 chosen men who were warriors, to fight against the house of Israel, to bring the kingdom again to Rehoboam, the son of Solomon. Well, fortunately, he was advised against that, and he refrained from doing that. And the northern tribes go home, and they elect Jeroboam king. He's officially crowned as king of the northern tribes. Rehoboam is the king of Judah and, to some extent, Benjamin, and that forms the southern kingdom. So we now have these two kingdoms. So what we have then, let's go to our sketches. In scene one, we have the kingdom split to the north and to the south. This is Israel. Is that red okay for reading? Can you see that all right? And Judah. And what happens is, usually when Scripture speaks of Israel, it's speaking of the northern tribes. And you can tell from the context whether it means the whole thing of the northern tribes. It's speaking of the northern tribes, Israel, usually, and Judah is the southern tribe. So that's the division that we have in the land. So Rehoboam is settled in Jerusalem. Jeroboam's king in the north. Watch what happens. Now we come to Jeroboam institutes idolatry. Still in the same chapter, verse 26. Jeroboam thought to himself, the kingdom will now likely revolt to the house of David. If these people go up to offer sacrifices at the temple of the Lord in Jerusalem, they will again give their allegiance to their Lord Rehoboam, king of Judah. They will kill me and return to King Rehoboam. After seeking advice, these guys had lots of advisors. After seeking advice, the king made two golden calves. What? He said to the people, it's too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Here are your gods, Israel, who brought you out of Egypt. One he set up at Bethel and the other at Dan. Now, Bethel is actually down in the tribe of Benjamin. I mean, that's the south. That's as far south as you can go in Israel. You know, it's almost to Jerusalem. And Dan is way up in the north. And so he sets up these two idols, one in the north and one in the south. And this thing, verse 30, became a sin. The people came to worship the one at Bethel and went as far as Dan to worship the other. Verse 31, Jeroboam built shrines on high places. We talked about the high places last week. And appointed priests from all sorts of people, even though they were not Levites. He instituted a festival on the 15th day of the 8th month, like the festival held in Judah, and offered sacrifices on the altar. That's the state of affairs that we find at the end of this scene. We've got Rehoboam in the south, who has a tendency to attack the north, and he's advised against it, and so he refrains. We've got Jeroboam in the north who virtually sets up an idolatrous nation. I mean, pretty sad. We have the 12 tribes. God multiplied the people in Egypt, brought them out in the Exodus, brought them into the land, gave them all territory, and this is what it's come to. 120 years of rule by Saul, David, and Solomon, and for 200 years, this is the situation. We have the kings of Israel and Judah. Let's read a little bit in connection with somebody read for us. I'll move now to the kings of Israel and Judah. Somebody read for us 1 Kings 15, 9 to 11.
In the 20th year of Jeroboam, king of Israel, Asa became king of Judah, and he reigned in Jerusalem 41 years. His grandmother's name was Maacah, daughter of Abishah. Asa did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, as his father David had done. He expelled the male shrine prostitutes from the land and got rid of all the idols his father had made.
He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord. That's the phrase I wanted to get. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord. We go through the history of Judah for the next 200 years, and they have about 20 kings, and 8 of them have that phrase attached. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord. 12 of them, he did the opposite. Now, the 8 of them, I think, as I looked at the chronology, I think the 8 of them probably comprised about half the history. They reigned a little bit longer, and so they probably took up half. So for half the time, Judah, the king is doing what's right in the eyes of the Lord, and for the other half, he's doing what's bad in the eyes of the Lord. Then we go, so the point is, mostly the kings of Judah were bad.
You mean
No, Judah. Mostly the kings of Judah were bad. There were 8 out of the 20 who were good and 12 out of the 20 who were bad. All right? Now we go to Israel. Somebody read for us verses 25 and 26 in 1 Kings 15. That's a representative king of Israel. They have 19 kings. They don't last as long. They're only going to last half as long. The kingdom of Israel. They're going to last about 100 years, and they have 19 kings, and every single one is bad. Every single one. They're all bad. It's a really sad history. Fortunately, as the history is given in Kings and Chronicles, they're mixed, so that every once in a while you come up against a good king, and the rest of the time you're reading about all these bad kings, and you know what their main problem was? Idolatry. They were worshiping idols. They were, and at some times. They had temple prostitution. Sometimes they offered their sons and daughters. They offered their babies on the altar to Moloch, that obscene god. And I mean, it was awful, awful. And then you come to these good kings, and you get the flash of light when they turn and seek the Lord, and the Lord gives a revival. And it goes on as long as that king lives, and then you get a bad king and back in the valley again. I mean, it's a sad, sad situation for the most part. So what happens is, here's the big question. How is God going to cure them of idolatry? What's he going to have to do to cure them of idolatry? Because all the time, and you see in the side notes there, you see these lists of prophets. These prophets come at them, and when we read the prophets, that's what the prophets are preaching against. They're preaching against these bad kings who are leading the people into idolatry and all kinds of other really sad things. But prophet after prophet after prophet comes with the word of God, and almost always rejected. Sad situation. So how's God going to cure them? Well, the way he's going to cure them is to get them out of the land altogether. Oh, excuse me, scratch that word altogether. Not out of the land altogether, because there are people left in the land. But he's going to take, for the most part, take the people out of the land into exile. And so we come to scene two, Israel into exile. Maybe somebody would read for us, please, that first passage in Israel into exile, 2 Kings 17. 3 to 12. Well, I'll tell you what. Let's do it like this. Let me just sort of read selected parts of it, since it's a longer passage. 2 Kings 17:3. Shalmaneser, king of Assyria. Now, let me put this on the board, if I may. Remember, when we started out in Genesis, we had the Mediterranean Sea here and the land of Israel here, and then the Fertile Crescent goes over here. That big Fertile Crescent goes over here, and we start out with Abraham here, and the Lord leads him and he gets him to the land. So this Fertile Crescent is ruled at this time by the nation of Assyria, and then Babylon takes over and this becomes the territory of Babylon. This whole Fertile Crescent virtually becomes, at one point, the holding of Assyria, the kingdom of the what do you call it? The Empire of Assyria. and then it becomes the and then virtually the same territory becomes the Empire of Babylon. So when we talk about the northern tribes of Israel going into Assyria, we're talking about them going over here, you know, Iraq and Iran, those places. And then when we talk about Judah going to Babylon, it's kind of nice, you know, A comes first, that's Assyria, and B comes next, that's Babylon. So Israel goes into Assyria, and then Judah goes into Babylon. That's, they're going to virtually, you know, they're going to somewhere in this area. So here's where we begin then in 2 Kings 17. Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up to attack Hoshea, who had been Shalmaneser's vassal and had paid him tribute. Skip down, please, to verse 6. In the ninth year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria captured Samaria and deported the Israelites to Assyria. He settled them in Hala and Gozan, on the Haven River and in the towns of the Medes. So he kind of scattered them around a little bit, all right? Now, what he did at that time was, I don't know whether this is in our reading, when he took the Israelites over here, he took a bunch of people who were already over here and put them in Israel. So he kind of swapped the peoples, right? And these Gentiles who were here, he put in Israel, and then they began to intermarry with some of the people who were left in the land, and the result is the Samaritans. So when we read in the Gospels about Galilee, Samaria, and Judea, these Samaritans are in the middle. These are people who are the descendants of the children of Israel who were married to the Gentiles. And they brought in all kinds of pagan practices as well. Verse 7. All this took place because the Israelites had sinned against the Lord their God, who had brought them up out of Egypt. From under the power of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, they worshipped other gods and followed practices of the nations the Lord had driven out before them, as well as the practices of that the kings of Israel had instituted. And the Israelites secretly did things against the Lord their God that were not right. From watchtower to fortified city, they built themselves high places in all their towns. That's the picture that we have. And then we come to verse 12. They worshipped idols, though the Lord had said, "You shall not do this." And then verse 13. The Lord warned Israel and Judah through all his prophets and seers. Turn from your evil ways, observe my commands and decrees in accordance with the entire law that I commanded your ancestors to obey and that I delivered to you through my servants, the prophets. But they would not listen and were as stiff-necked as their ancestors. That's the kind of image that we are presented with when we look at the picture, that they rejected the prophets. And then when we come down to verse 22, the Israelites persisted in all the sins of Jeroboam and did not turn away from them until the Lord removed them from his presence, as he had warned through all his servants, the prophets. So the people of Israel were taken from their homeland into exile in Assyria, and they are still there. Now, we don't know exactly when this was written, but it was written sometime after these events, which seems obvious. But apparently it was written a long enough period after the events that the author put in there, and they're still there. They're still in Assyria. In fact, as a nation, as a people, they never come back. The northern tribes, the 10 northern tribes, never come back to the land. Individuals would come back, obviously. I mean, people migrate. Individuals would come back, but the 10 tribes, the Israel tribes, never actually come back as a unit. They're never recovered. And so you have all kinds of wonderful theories about the 10 lost tribes of Israel and all that stuff, which is a bunch of... because all of the people were not deported to Assyria, just some of the people, just a reasonable number of them, but there were still people left in the land. And so there are not actually lost tribes. The land wasn't stripped of every individual. There were a number of people left in the land. The records from Assyria tell us, and I was reading this in, I don't know, somewhere. I read that the Assyrian records show that they took about 250,000 people into Assyria. Now, there must have been more than 250,000 people in the northern tribes. And so there would be a good number of people left in the land. But it was significant enough that that they were taken that it's spoken of as the tribes of Israel being taken into Assyria. Now, when we look at this, here's what we have, just to get a sense of the chronology, right? 722 BC. Let's try and set up a few dates. 722 BC is a pretty good date to keep in your mind as a touchstone. That's when Assyria attacked Jerusalem. There was a siege that lasted, I think, about 3 years. And then there were deportation, maybe more than one deportation, when the people were taken into Assyria, all right? When we come to the next part where we deal with the deportation of Judah into Babylon, we're talking, the key date there is 586. 586 BC. So Israel goes into exile 722 and Babylon in at 586. Now, that's a little more complicated. There were actually three deportations around this time, but 586 is the biggie. That's the one that's described in the passages that we're going to read. So Israel then is taken into exile. And then the kings of Judah, we're given records of the kings of Judah in 2 Kings 18 through 25. And then we come to scene 3, Judah into exile in 2 Kings 25. All right, let's look at how Judah goes into exile in 2 Kings 25. This is before the exile, the period before the exile. This is the end of the story. You notice that 2 Kings 25 is the last chapter in 2 Kings.
Where are they now? Where are they going to exile?
So the people of Judah are down in the south, you know, in the south of the land. We've got the division just above Jerusalem, or Benjamin, just above Jerusalem. The northern tribes have gone into Assyria. The southern Judah and Benjamin are still living in Israel, still living in the land, right? Babylon defeats Assyria. The Babylonians defeat the Assyrians and take over world empire. I shouldn't have used that term. We talk about the world empire. There's the Orient, right? There's China and Japan. I mean, what? Our half of the world, right? So they take over world empire, and in our little narrow little sense, because we only recognize the Western world. And so the Babylonians have taken over, and then they come at Jerusalem. Remember, they rule. I mean, this is all their territory. And the reason that they attack Jerusalem is usually because the king in Jerusalem is going to Egypt for help. He wants to form an alliance with Egypt so that they can defeat whoever's ruling them. I mean, it's all very mixed. You think about the politics of the Middle East now. It was the same. It hasn't changed. They'll go to whoever will protect them, and they'll pay tribute to them. So we come to chapter 25. Zedekiah is the last king of Judah. He's the last king in Jerusalem. He has actually been set up by Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar has come in about 605 or perhaps 607 B.C., and he has besieged the city and all that stuff, and he has gotten the people to be his vassals, and he set up Zedekiah as the king. Well, then there's a bit, Zedekiah starts to fool around, and Nebuchadnezzar comes back. So in the ninth year of Zedekiah's reign, on the 10th day of the 10th month, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, marched against Jerusalem with his whole army. He encamped outside the city and built siege works all around it. The city was kept under siege until the 11th year of King Zedekiah. Now, I put in the notes a two-year siege. That's a little bit of an exaggeration. It was about a year and a half. It was from, it started in I think, January of 587 and went to July of 586 B.C. And so it lasted about 18 months. Down to verse 8. On the seventh day of the fifth month in the 19th year, this is all very precise, the 19th year of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, commander of the imperial guard, an official of the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem, and he set fire to the temple of the Lord, the royal palace, and all the houses of Jerusalem, and every important building he burned down. The whole Babylonian army, under this command of the imperial guard, broke down the walls around Jerusalem. Nebuchadnezzar, this is in 586, Nebuchadnezzar, the commander of the guard, carried into exile the people who remained in the city, along with the rest of the population and those who had deserted to the king of Babylon. But the commander left behind some of the poorest people of the land to work the vineyards and fields. That's why we sort of single out 586, because that's what's described here. There's a passage that there's a kind of summary of this whole area given by Isaiah, and he says there were three deportations, and this is the middle one. This 586 seems to be the main one and the middle one. One in 597, one in 586, and one in 581. So we're talking about a period of almost 20 years over which all this drama took place. The temple and the walls are torn down, and the people go into exile. Verse 18 of 2 Kings 25. The commander of the guard took as prisoners Sariah, the chief priest, Zephaniah, priest next in rank, and the three doorkeepers, and all of these still in the city he took, and all that. And he goes on and talks about who he took. Verse 21, then at Riblah, in the land of Hamath, the king had them executed. So Judah went into captivity away from the land. And this is messy stuff. This is the kind of stuff that the United Nations gets involved in today. But or the U.S. without the United Nations. So, I mean, it's a sad story, right? The only reason, I think this is biblical, the only reason that the Lord gives them for preserving any of them is the faithfulness of David. David was faithful to the Lord, and God spared the nation for his sake. Take a look at, go back if we may to chapter 19, 2 Kings 19. Verse 30. Once more, a remnant of the kingdom of Judah will take root. Will take root below and bear fruit above. For out of Jerusalem will come a remnant, and out of Mount Zion a band of survivors. 34. I will defend this, this is God speaking, I will defend this city and save it for the sake and for my sake and for the sake of my David, my servant. So God gives those two reasons why he's going to stick with them. Virtually all the people are out of the land. There are a few poor people left in the land, and perhaps some others. And God says, for the sake of David, my servant, and for my sake, I will preserve the city. He's going to restore. He's going to bring back a remnant. Yeah, David was faithful to the Lord, but this is about grace, right? God is going to preserve his name. He's going to preserve his testimony in the land. He's going to do it for the sake of David, his servant, but also for his own sake. Amazing. Amazing story. What, you know this story. What... what do we learn from it? Let me fill in the last two cells here. All right, there's scene one. Here's scene two. This is Israel into exile. Scene three is Judah into exile. That's it. That's all there is. If you take the period, if you take the period between the split of the kingdom and the two parts going into exile, it's just a sad story of, mostly a sad story of king after king after king after king who rejects the word of God. God had said to Solomon, because you disobeyed me and became idolatrous, I'm going to tear the kingdom away from you. He says at a number of points later, the only reason I'm preserving anything is for the sake of David, who was faithful to me. David obviously made his mistakes and sinned his sins, but he was faithful to the Lord. And that's the only reason God preserved anything. I told you it was going to be a sad story. Right? What do we learn from this? God disciplines his children? Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. In fact, the New Testament tells us God disciplines those he loves. People who discipline their children do so not usually to vent their anger, but they do so to make their children turn out the way they want them to turn out and not the other way. Sam?
Also, God keeps his promises.
He keeps his promises. Yeah. He had promised David that he would have a kingdom, a perpetual kingdom. Well, yeah, and that's hard to understand too, isn't it? Since that's not true now. But Sam,
God's justice.
Yeah. Yeah, God's justice.
He's slow to wrath. I mean, he let this go for years.
Yeah. 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 He gave them. I think he gave them plenty of time. A couple of hundred years. Richard.
Sin is serious.
Sin is serious. Yeah. Yeah.
God hates idolatry.
God hates idolatry. Ten Commandments. Think back to what we said about Ten Commandments, right? What was the first commandment? You shall have no other gods before me. And then he says, you shall not make any graven image or any kind of such thing And that's, I mean, it happened like that. If we just take the reading of the story.
And I say Solomon was sinning against knowledge. I mean, he knew. In the Second Chronicles, it talks about how Solomon didn't want Pharaoh's daughter, his wife, to live in a certain place because the holiness of God was there.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not like this was kind of an idea he had or a vague
notion. Yeah.
In his early life, he was adamant about God's holiness.
Yeah.
And there's this erosion, and he's actually sinning against knowledge, and that God actually appeared to him twice.
And the thing he asked God for was wisdom to rule his people well. And that's still a big conundrum in my mind. What do we have this guy who is recognized as the wisest man who lived, and yet he's the one who has no heart? Or he had a divided heart. He had a divided heart.
He had wisdom but no courage, not enough courage. Standing against the peer pressure of his wives, they kept saying, "If you love me, you build me a temple."
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he wanted all these wives and concubines, but with them he got their idols. They brought their idols.
He's the one that penned the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom.
Yeah, I know. I mean, you get all of this wisdom in the book of Proverbs, and it's written by Solomon, the guy who had a divided heart. Yeah. Do
they
we
know the truth, but they don't?
Yeah. Do we have idolatry today?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, figuratively, we have idolatry. I think so. We don't have in this. Let me back up and say this: in this country, we don't have, for the most part, Christians bowing down to idols. I know there are some parts of the church where they have statues and all that stuff. We don't have Christians bowing down to idols, and I suspect that the reason we don't have Christians bowing down to idols is because the devil doesn't need us to. He's got other ways. He's got other ways of, and some of those we call spiritual idols, things that we worship, things that we bow to other than the true God, and therefore we don't have to have idols in our churches.
God isn't foremost in our thoughts. We are being idolatrous.
Yeah.
God and Satan brings all these things that take up our mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. These other things that take up our mind and our thoughts.
Yeah.
Yep. God honors true faithfulness beyond one generation. I mean, David's ability to be faithful.
Yeah.
God honored that. Something to aspire to live well.
Yeah.
Children.
Yes, absolutely. If the sins of the fathers fall on the children, so do the blessings.
Yeah.